All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Conditions and Maintenance of Certification Task Force. We have Raj Ratwani, one of the co-chairs, also Carolyn Peterson and Ken Kawamoto. Do we have any other task force members on the phone at this time? Okay. Hearing none, I will turn it over to Kate first, just to give us a rundown of today's agenda, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. Thanks, Lauren. So I know we wanted to continue the discussion of the recommendations. On the last call, there were some questions that came up with regard to API, fire, and the bulk data movement. So Avinash has, the Deputy Director of the Office of Technology at ONC, has agreed to join us today, so he could help clarify the proposal or respond to any applicable questions that the task force members may have. So I guess I will, Raj, if you want to start it off, I don't know what recommendations we should get started with regard to the API or just generally if we want to talk.
Yeah, I'd say why don't we start generally? Denise has been running most of these meetings, so please bear with me as I kind of jump into where we are now. I think where we last left off was on recommendation 22, but I think there are some of the questions about fire and the APIs. Specifically, it looks like between recommendation 19 and 20, there may be something there. And Ken, I'm not sure if this is an area where you had some questions and might be able to drive some of this, but I'd like to use Avinash's time while we have it. And Avinash, thank you for joining us.
No problem. And I can stay a little longer. I know 3:30, I have another meeting, but that's an internal ONC meeting. So, I can certainly stay longer than 3:30 if needed.
Okay.
Well, this is Ken. I think the main question I had was what's the state of the bulk data spec, its maturity? And I think the big picture question is it ready to be included as a requirement, or is it something that requires a little bit more work? So I think that was the big picture question, at least for me.
Sure, thank you. We'll get right into it. And hi, this is Avinash Shanbhag from ONC. Just to kind of set the stage, and just to make sure, Ken, clarify where the bulk API standard is, the HL7 Firebase bulk access API is the standard that you're referring to, right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, so just for context, that standard was developed, I want to say, on about a year and a half ago. It's currently being it's balloted in the Fire Release 4. And the reason I mentioned that is because if you look at our current NPRM, the proposal actually references Fire Release 2, and we acknowledge in that in the NPRM that because the standardized bulk access API is not available in the Fire Release 2 for population services, it's a functional requirement that and not a standards-based requirement in the current proposal as proposed. But Ken, to your question, there are two components of bulk API standard. The base, which is the querying for fire-related data, is actually part of the Fire Release 4 that was released at the end of 2018, and it's part of the fire infrastructure. There is a related component, which is the security componentry that goes with bulk data access. That's similar to how a single patient access, there is a smart app authorization guide. For the bulk API, there is a parallel implementation guide called backend services standard that's really based on OAuth and smart app launch framework, but had some distinctions just because it's for more than one resources, and it had some other properties that needed to be added in. That standard was tested and validated in multiple countathons over the last year. And currently, it's actually being balloted in the upcoming May HL7 working group meeting. So in terms of like just the two components, the bulk access API is already in the FHIR 4 infrastructure, so it's part of the base release 4 standard. And the security components, which is goes by the name backend access, backend services implementation guide, is currently targeted for a May ballot at HL7. Does that help?
Yes, I think it does. I think the I'm a little bit confused because I thought perhaps the bulk data was in fact reference for population health management purposes as a requirement, separate from the whole EHR extract kind of notion, but maybe I'm mistaken there.
Yeah, just to clarify, yeah, what we have described in the G10 API proposal, we have referenced population services, but because of our we refer FHIR standard DSTU2, our specific proposal is that, you know, we separate it into search and secure connection and data response. For data response, we have said that it needs to be, the data needs to be FHIR release 2 compatible and compliant with the Argonaut profiles. But for actual API and for search criteria, we have actually not specified a standard. We have made it a functional requirement. The only question is, like we also, as you know, have put the request for comment as 4 options, and one of the options is actually 2 of the options are either pick FHIR release 3 and 4, or FHIR release 2 and 4, or FHIR release 4. And really, if any of the options that get selected are based on FHIR 4, then we would you know, definitely have the comment. We will appreciate comments from the from your group about putting in the standardized population service API. But yes, right now, as proposed in the NPRM, we have not specified the bulk access API standard because it's not part of the FHIR release 2.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Avinash. Are there questions from other folks on the call?
Is it within our purview to recommend if we go with, if ONC goes with FHIR 4 to use the FHIR 4 bulk query mechanism? If so, I think then we need to really get into the is it appropriate or not, or I and is it mature enough at this current state?
I mean, that's, so this is Avinash again. I mean, that's definitely something you could comment on. From a maturity perspective, just kind of, again, as I mentioned, it's been about a year of that the development of the standard, and it has through multiple countathons. So I would say that from at least my own personal perspective, I think it's reached a stage of maturity that is actually already part of the FHIR release 4. But having said that, you know, defer to you all to do your own analysis and or any understanding of the maturity levels.
Avinash, does that represent live implementations or just connect-a-thon demonstrations?
Right now, it's still connect-a-thon implementations just because it's right now part of the FHIR release 4. So our expectation is because it just got into the FHIR 4 at the end of December when FHIR 4 was released, our expectation is that in the coming, you know, coming months when vendors start implementing FHIR 4, that's when the bulk access API as built out in the standard will get implement, at least it will get put into vendor products.
So just so we kind of understand, I guess, when we recommend use of FHIR for, you know, medication data in release 4, we at least have real world experience of implementations of DSTU 2, SDU 3, FHIR medication services. But here we don't have any prior implementations because it's a newly available with release 4. And so if we recommend it, we're recommending something that has never been implemented in real life. to be required at every health system in a certain time period?
Yes. To be specific, yeah. This is currently only gone through Connectathons.
I think it would be prudent to differentiate the timelines, at least for pieces where, let me go back a step. I know we talked about previously in the task force that we would see it as undesirable to implement bulk data queries for population purposes in non-standard ways, which was what was proposed by ONC with the expectation that they were proposing DSTU2, which doesn't have a standard way to do that. And the task force had discussed and felt that a lot of non-standard implementations was undesirable. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think one of the advantages of R4 is that it permits standard implementations. But I do think that it might be a recommendation for us to consider to differentiate timelines for things that are already deployed in production and could be upgraded to R4 on a different timeline than implementing a completely untested standard.
Yeah, this is Ken. I would completely agree with that. I mean, we want a standard, and hopefully bulk data would be the way to do it, but before requiring folks, we probably should be looking for some production implementations and experience.
Sorry, Ken, before you jump in, just to kind of close out some of that, is there anybody on the call that has a different perspective on that? I also agree with both of you. I see that John joined. I'm not sure if he's on the call yet. Carolyn, others have a perspective on the bulk data issue that's coming up?
This is Carolyn. Yeah, I am in favor of not going with something where we really don't have much real-world experience. I think that's probably not a great thing to recommend at this point.
Okay. So unless there's a different perspective on this, I'd say we should probably go ahead and make that change. Okay. Ken, please go ahead.
I have a related question. So when I ask some folks on that I work with about, when they evaluate whether to use it, they thought that the data formats, et cetera, looked good, but maybe the query mechanism, et cetera, was still fairly early. Can you, using the current specification, say things like, for patients who have Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance and who have diabetes as specified by, having a diabetes on their problem list with these codes, tell me what their current hemoglobin, most recent hemoglobin A1C test was? Like, is that, and like, give it to me as bulk data, is that something that's supported, or is it more along the lines of like, there's some offline mechanism to specify here's medical record numbers that I'm interested in and just give me all their data? Like, is it possible to do those kind of fairly typical population health management related data queries using this mechanism?
I think this will, each one will have to be evaluated. The way the functionality is bind, it lets you create, it basically lets you do an asynchronous. So it's basically an access of multiple patients by group ID. So what is expected is like there is this API call that's based on a certain group ID, and the patient population that's part of the group ID is left up to policy. So if you're taking your example, Ken, if it's like a Blue Cross Blue Shield, whatever is the patient cohort that you want to query on, the mechanism by which you come up with a list of patients' IDs that represent your population is separate, but then assume that that you create a virtual group ID for it, then you can certainly access the relevant data for that group ID and you get whatever is the cohort of patient population. Now, when it comes to this chain, what you mentioned about getting patients or information that have diabetes and whose H1A1C are elevated or the like, those are chained searches, and that's really a base fire functionality. So it's nothing that is specific to the bulk API here. It's what it is the FHIR-based standard allows you to query patients, as you are aware of, based on certain chained information, that is chained by means information in related resources. So, you know, patients with medications or patients that have connected resource data. So you'll have to build those APIs and search query mechanisms to be able to stratify that data. But in terms of the groups of patients that belong to a certain, you know, cohort or certain section or certain query scope, that will have to be, that's kind of, at least in the bulk API proposal, is separately curated based and by the actual by the system that's developed and supported, and then really there's a group ID virtual collection that's used to query for that cohort. Does that help? I mean that's the kind of, and then of course there are and then there are additional parameters that just to kind of close the thought. I think just in terms of what it allows is there are some additional parameters that tell you that the start dates and end dates and any updates to it. So there are mechanisms by which once you get access to that cohort and you build that population, then you can get from a certain date to a certain date or, you know, anything about that. So there are those additional query mechanisms which are specific bulk access just to kind of curtail the amount of data. But in terms of the type of data, you would use basically the FHIR query, underlying query parameters.
That sounds good. I guess related to whether we sort of specifically recommend that this be pursued at a different timeline, et cetera, is the work on the bulk data queries, like how active is it? Like, is it something that, like, if we want to be able to reference and make required at some later date, like, is there, like, active ONC-supported projects, Argonaut initiatives, like, or, like, because it does seem like additional work is needed to address things, like, well, what do you do when, like, the notion of, like, who am I talking about, what population am I talking about, and leaving it completely off-spec and sort of point-to-point seems, like, not ideal. Like, is there, like, active work to try to address those things, or is it something that, you know, if we wanted that kind of thing to be supported when it's referenced in regulation at some point, that we need to actually recommend that more work be done there?
So you can certainly request for more work to be done there. As far as I'm aware, the consensus of the HL7 community was that the bulk API, just the bulk API infrastructure-related activities, basically the ability to call a cohort of patients by a group ID, being able to query and get data of a large cohort, they felt it was mature enough. So it's in the standard. And as far as I'm aware, last year, before the HL7 FHIR community adopted it into the FHIR 4 release, Argonaut pilot group actually tested it and validated that it worked. So really, that was, like, you know, I mentioned Kantathons, but that was a Kantathon, and then there was pilot work that was done by Argonauts for both the bulk API and the parallel security components, the backend services. All went into the final chain, the final standard that was part of release. So as far as at least what I'm aware of, the FHIR community feels that it is kind of ready being, you know, it's ready to be put into FHIR release 4, and they have put it in and they feel it's ready to be implemented. I don't know if there's additional work that's been going on in the underlying standard, though, you know, if there are additional use cases that come up that require implementation guides on top of bulk API, that certainly, you know, I haven't heard about it, but could come. I think right now the main area where work is happening, as I mentioned, was that the security component, the backend services API, was tested and validated during the Argonaut pilot sprints. But because it did not get into the smart app launch framework implementation guide, but it was a separate IG that was deemed in parallel useful to be developed, that even though that was validated and piloted by Argonaut, right now it's being balloted through HL7 so that it becomes a standard that's, has the public and the larger stakeholder community input. So that's the one that's currently being at least worked on as much as I should say, getting ready for the May ballot. But once the backend services gets balloted in May, along with the fire release force bulk API, technically the work is done. I mean, we do anticipate some ONC angle. I would say that we do anticipate supporting and piloting the use of those APIs in large scale. For example, I think you are aware one of the LEAP grants that we awarded last year does reference the use of population APIs and use of population APIs for machine learning. So we do anticipate its use in the future. But in terms of standardization activity, I think we reached. I don't see us doing anything actively unless we hear use cases that require more implementation guide development. Does that help? I mean, that's where at least I see the current work activities on the bulk API and backend.
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Are we other questions for Avinash while we have them? Okay. So let's jump back into the recommendations. Sasha, I see that you were kind enough to modify 20. Any further comments on recommendation 20 that's being displayed now?
Yeah, I tried to reflect our conversation, though the wording could probably be better there. I'm open to any suggestions from others.
That current wording looks for me. Others?
No, that looks good.
Ben, you okay with that?
Yes, sorry, just reading it now. There's something on top of it right now. Can we get that document again up?
There it is.
It just, for some reason, there's like a conversation on top of it that's over.
I'm able to see it here, so I can read it out loud. The part that Sasha just added was, if ONC identifies R4 fire for implementation, the standard method could be used for bulk queries, but on a different timeline than implementation of more established R4 implementation guides.
I think the only question is, you know, did we explicitly call out things like there should be more real world testing and refinement of the spec as needed before it becomes required for everyone? I'm assuming in real world testing, people will run into things like, well, there's common patterns of like subpopulations you want to query because it's probably fairly unusual. You want to pull the entire record for every single person in the EHR. And it seems like it would be more useful if there was a way to define that other than it'll be done completely off spec.
I don't know. I guess one of the challenges I see with real world testing is that when you're testing something that's totally new and doesn't have any actual users yet, I don't actually know how you'd test it, right? So, like, if I wanted to implement this and then implement it, I need some sort of app that's built on top of it. And if no one's implemented the fire services yet, then there probably aren't any apps that use it yet. And I don't know that the real-world testing that you're likely to do with a harness or with whatever app happens to be available is going to be widely representative of the type of thing you're looking for, Ken. I guess in my mind, that would be better accounted for by actual live implementations, not real-world testing.
Oh, okay. Maybe I just called it what it shouldn't have been. But, like, I guess the big picture notion of, like, we recommend, we believe in this thing. It sounds promising, but, we recommend that steps be taken to make it more mature and validated before and whatever the wording is, I was sort of thinking the two were the same, but through actual implementations, perhaps.
So I just added a sentence that said, the task force would like to see successful implementations prior to requiring adoption across the industry. Does that seem to reflect it?
Yeah. That sounds good. I mean, bottom line, if it's real implemented and it provides value just the way it is, then that's great. And if not, I'm sure people will figure out, like, oh, this is what needs to get tweaked.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, great. If everyone's on board with that, let's keep moving. I think we made it through 21 last time. Is that right? I think we can jump down to Rec 22.
Do we need to incorporate the 328 comment into 21 in some fashion?
328 comment.
So for the what I had put on the memo, I added like a specific recommendation just to add for these criteria. As we discussed, I guess it was 328.
Okay.
Okay, so jumping down to 22, and here I'm kind of just following the guidance that Denise had given me and things that we had talked about. But I think there was this last note down where it says 328 at the bottom of the portion that's projected now that we should briefly discuss. So this is based off of Denise's comment where she spoke to several CIOs. And there seemed to be some concern around what happens if an app developer sort of doesn't work out but still has, in her words, kind of keys to the kingdom and have access or would have had access. Are there some security precautions that need to be thought about? And John, you may have had some comments in the space as well when we discussed this a few phone calls ago.
Yeah, I know that I... Sorry, Sasha, go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
No, I was just going to say the question of persisting or what happens after an application is severed, if you will, for their connection. I know in our experience that would, relative to any new data, basically there's no connection. The concern may be over controlling data that they've already obtained through that connection. But you know, if it's consumer use case, it's really no different than a consumer having obtained an electronic copy of their information by other means, or if it's been transformed into another form for a different API accessing application, it's going to be under their control. But if they're disconnected and it's been done under a normal process of removal, I may not be following the question exactly right, but we are not going to, they're not going to persist an ability to connect.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to John's point. My understanding of the way that OAuth works to provide access seems like it already addresses the concern that Denise and the CIO she's talked with have in their minds. So there's kind of different levels of keys, I guess, in a sense, right? So a particular application with a specific like URL endpoint might need to be registered. But then also the user with authorization to a particular data set, so in many examples, like the patient who wants to get access to their own data, would have to be presenting their credentials. And so even if a particular developer registered an application and then like got fired from the company that registered the application, I mean, that doesn't give them the other things that would be necessary, like a user's authentication or anything, to have persistent access to the EHR data. I mean, I guess the app, if the app has some sort of database and they don't terminate access to the fired person, that could certainly be a security risk, but that's a risk of any company, right? Any company that has access to sensitive data needs to have policies to remove access for terminated employees. And so I think that a lot of the security protections that are already proposed mitigate the risk Denise identifies. But I do know that I also hear a lot of concern about app vetting. That's some of the questions that we asked earlier in terms of clarifying what was expected there. So I respect sort of the anxiety that I think Denise is expressing in this comment. I hear that from other stakeholders also. But I don't know that the sort of app developer staff person gets fired scenario specifically, unless I'm misunderstanding it, is a huge risk. I think other security protections of OAuth account for that.
Okay, that's great. And I think, Sasha, to your point, I think some of the vetting things are addressed in the bullet points up above. So I feel like we have that pretty well covered. Ken, Carolyn, any other thoughts around the points that Denise was bringing up?
I don't think so for me.
Okay.
No.
Okay, so I think, Sasha, thanks for documenting that. I can talk with Denise about it and just kind of fill her in on the context here, but I think what you and John have described makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
And if we're missing something about the scenario, maybe someone will chime in public comment or something. Help us.
Yeah.
Yep, good point. Okay, 23 was talking about the scope of EHI export. And I think this was also making sure that we're in sync or aligned with what's happening in the information blocking discussions. Any additional thoughts on this one?
The only other thing I'd offer, and I don't remember if we really talked about this in this context, while the concept of EHI bears a definition and we understand it's intent, I think ONC can do work to make clearer that it doesn't suddenly implicate all of the EHI that may be held, particularly in an integrated system. So what I mean by that is, like we are, we have in a common production domain, revenue cycle, supply chain, ancillary solutions, scheduling, things of that nature that are really not any part of any basis of certified EHR technology we've ever represented in the scope of a certified module. And there certainly are certain levels of data objects like a patient or a person or an encounter that you really can't divide very well if you're applying a definition of EHI and all data held by cert, but integration does not mean inclusion. So, for example, a supply chain system that necessarily occupies a database or table space as part of an overall architecture of a large integrated waterfront system doesn't suddenly become EHI held by cert just by virtue of that fact, and that would actually be a kind of a discriminatory basis of judgment compared to non-integrated portfolios from the same vendor. So my suggestion is they need to either make clear that a vendor is going to need to develop the way that they would apply the EHI definition to what their certified module holds, or certainly to make allowance for the fact that integration does not mean default inclusion in that EHI definition held by cert. So either way, the way they proposed it, that's a burden that I presume that HIT vendors are going to have to sort through to provide a fairly reasonable level of inclusion of what belongs in that definition and what is not within that definition, unless they are, frankly to me, overreaching by suggesting that simple integration colors the nature of what all is included by some kind of default trigger. Does that make sense?
I think so. John, do you think that's already accounted for in what we recommend, or should we add a sentence?
Yeah.
As I read this, Not really, because a legal medical record is broader than scope of cert for most purposes. I would say that it, matter of fact, I'm not so sure about the legal medical record being the right statement. And what does this do to me if I am presenting an EHR module that's much smaller in scope? Is a legal medical record at all? Now you get into, let's say I present an EHR module for public health reporting or for quality measure reporting, and it's a fairly standalone solution. The legal medical record definition really doesn't have anything to do with me, but maybe I'm not having to certify to the EHR export, but it depends on the construction of my module. So because that is no reliable base of definition, I think it needs to be that there is a requirement that the HIT developer needs to provide a reasonable definition, plain language, if you will, as best as they can, of what is EHI held by the scope of their certified module, and provide a good statement of how they would, I don't know if you want to say defend that or establish that through written documentation. I don't think the definition is very functional as it is, unless you just simply say it's everything that's held in a production domain where CERT is resident, and that's way overreaching.
Right.
Okay, I tried to capture what John was saying.
Yeah, I think that's good.
I don't
much
know why
simpler
I didn't
statement,
like product.
Sasha.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a nice, simple statement. You got the point of it.
Carolyn, can others okay with this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not a legal authority, I think, or at least have the familiarity that John and Sasha do, but I think that sounds reasonable.
This might also, and I just added another sentence, but Arian Malik had raised in the larger high-tech discussion a concern that the legal medical record was not like a defined concept under HIPAA,
he
didn't want to introduce more terms without definition, which I respect. So I just added as another point that this alternative that John proposed seems like it would also address Arian's concern because it avoids the concept of an undefined term in that way.
Yeah. It operates with the term of EHI, but it's applying that term to what you hold in boundaries of the CERT module.
Right. And I guess the other factor of it, John, would be not just EHI held by the certified module, but it would have to accommodate, I guess, in this alternative proposal, the same types of concerns we discussed earlier, which would be like incomplete information, a half-written note was one of the examples,
or
research information would not want to be exported if that would invalidate the research study.
Yeah, I think that's a very good statement. I know something we came across was it was very unclear, for example, of what to do with history and audit trails that go towards prior states of the record. You know, are you exporting the current, completed record entry? Do you really need to export the prior versions? Do you deal with transitory data like all of our I'm pretty sure Epic does many similar things. Concepts of like sticky notes and communications between staff that happen to leverage messaging capabilities. So they need a more elaborate definition of EHI probably too, but as long as it's a reasonably workable definition, it's one that will exist in this final rule and should be what informs the way a vendor develops a written statement of what EHI held in scope of the CERT module means. But I absolutely agree. They need to take on some of the kind of, if you want to call them secondary considerations of the structure of a medical record and really call out what's important to export that results in a whole integral record being exported. And I don't think legal medical record actually as such exists in anything. There are definitions of required content in lots of things, but I don't think there is an actual, beyond at least not the borders of one state, legal medical record.
Yeah, I agree. I think legal medical record is often locally interpreted by a particular health system with some amount of commonality,
yeah.
Right? Like, I've never heard of a health system that included half-finished notes in the legal medical record, but there is a degree of variability that comes from, you know, each group's compliance or legal department taking a slightly different approach.
And to the credit of what that language may have been trying to do was to head off exactly what you just mentioned with, you know, interim forms of data, incomplete forms of data.
Yeah.
So maybe it's preserve the concept, but don't use the term as the scoping definition.
Okay. So I tried to articulate that in what became a lengthy recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Okay, this, I mean, this also works for me, certainly not my area, not my area either, but.
Yep, looks good.
All right.
Okay. Okay, so moving on, if everyone's okay with that. So I think the next one is 27, I believe.
Yeah. Just kind of. Go right in. I think
yeah.
I was going to.
Yeah.
So multiple things here. Probably the biggest thing is this criteria as it's proposed is just simply too broad and unwieldy for real practical effect. So what I mean by that is that you've got almost three major subsets of transactions represented in this list. You could probably argue more, but they appeal to different audiences, and to ask any one audience to have to adopt the capabilities of this because it is going to become a required part of the base EHR definition and part of the required capabilities of CERT for adoption in any sense. You have a subset of prescriber-oriented transactions. You have a set of long-term care-oriented transactions, and you have a set of pharmacy-only-oriented transactions. And just take the example of a prescriber working in a physician practice setting. You're asking them to adopt capabilities of CERT that have nothing to do with anything they have any ability to ever make use of, if it's the pharmacy transactions, for example. So that's the first issue. The second issue is I don't think it works to just simply make criteria optional in the same within one criteria. Granted, if we answer the question of optional to whom, if it's optional to certify to them, that may work for a lot of cases, but if you do certify to them, they are part of the scope of the same criteria, and the possession requirements for ONC is you have to have full legal licensure to everything that's within scope of a certified EHR module. I think the only way to really work around these kinds of issues is to separate this proposed criteria into more than one, possibly three. So one would be to retain as a required scope of a criteria the prescriber-oriented workflow. That's probably the way most of the market thinks about e-prescribing and what traditionally has fallen within the historic definitions of e-prescribing functionality for EHR. Dating back to the Stark and anti-kickback safe harbors, and then separate out for long-term care, for pharmacy, optional criteria that are not part of the definition of CERT and not part of the definition of the base EHR. That way, you are effectively supporting what has been the traditional principal policy audience of the use of certified EHR technology for hospitals and clinicians and physicians, and you could allow for certification of those other criteria for those who wish to pursue them without saddling the whole burden on you know, a provider or hospital audience who has no interest in certain of the transactions. So that's the gist of it. So maybe stop there and let people respond to that. But that was the main thing I wanted to raise.
John, I had read over and added a comment yesterday, and I think you're spot on. I hadn't thought about the implications of making certain ones optional in the sense of what if a product wants to certify as a pharmacy product? It doesn't really make sense, right? Because then they'd still have the optionality doesn't – the way I had proposed it
doesn't do them
really
any good,
that.
Right.
Right.
Yep, exactly.
So I think I very much appreciated your insight and concern here, and I agree. The only, I guess, suggestion I might have is within the prescriber applicable group. I'm worried about putting the REMS transactions on a 1-1-2020 certification timeline.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. Here's something that we've been chewing on, and I don't know quite how to say it, but I'll try. So ONC has clearly written the language in the rule with a recognition, to me at least, that CMS has historically had a softness about the firmness of Part D compliance dates. In every single case since the original e-prescribing rulemaking back in about 2005 that adopted, I think it was 5.1, every single time CMS has either moved the compliance date or declined to enforce it. And I can't say that'll happen this time around, but that, you know, certainly on a lot of the industry's mind, to some people, I think even believing that's a very predictable thing that'll happen. We can't necessarily say with any preordination that will happen, but I think it is good to do something like I think you were about to suggest, and maybe making the REMS transactions optional, at least for 1-1-20, or at least do something to not make them, you know, instantly effective as a result of the 1-1-20 date if the 10.6 criteria is to be retired, the current B3, if I have that reference right. And now, at the same time, you know, it seems to be a kind of a weirdness, but not everybody seems to want to acknowledge, at the federal level, wants to acknowledge the reality of the presence of SureScripts, and they've announced support for doing data transformation through December 1 of 2020. I don't think in any sense we would suggest trying to carry things beyond that date, and I'm not suggesting putting that kind of stuff in a regulation, but that's a market reality. And the prescribing transactions are a little unique in that they are truly voluntary for Part D under the if you do electronic transacting, then you have to use the standard. But that doesn't carry weight to other programs. It doesn't require use of electronic. Whereas if you retire the 10.6 criteria and you make it part of the definition of cert, you kind of are playing a stronger tactic there to compel adoption. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in either suggesting deferring the retirement of the 10.6 criteria to some later date, or making optional the REMS transactions, and maybe you pick a later date for those to become required, something of that order.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
okay.
REMS is new,
go ahead.
Too. So if someone wants to use REMS, I think this is the standard they should use, and it would be reasonable they certify to it. But I think there aren't even any other REM systems available to use it with yet, as far as I know. And so I don't think people are going to want to start using it on 1-1-2020. Maybe we make it a separate set of certification, and so that it wouldn't impede the ability to get certified and use cert for the prescriber applicable criteria, and people could phase in use of REMs more slowly.
All right, so watching the clock here, let's see if we can break this one down into two segments just to get everybody's kind of feedback on it. So I think, John and Sasha, the first proposal is to break it up into these three components by prescriber, LTC, and pharmacy. Any other perspectives on that first recommendation? Is everybody okay with doing that?
I think one last suggestion, and I think I can't see if it was on the screen, but the get message transaction, it just keeps showing up like a bad boomerang. I don't, Sasha, you may know, I don't even think that has been used in any real way, not for intermediated exchange through SureScripts, which is, you know, 95% plus of the market for transaction volume. Is that even worthy of inclusion? It's been in there since the very beginning. To my knowledge, we've really never seen much use of it. It's an old model of retrieval of messages that's kind of an electronic mailbox form, not an intermediated exchange.
I don't see a value for it. I mean, I guess I don't know of anyone who uses the polling mechanism that would even
right.
make it message applicable. So I guess I... in the document suggested a little bit of different formatting along those lines, which we can look at after we take public comment.
Okay. Good. That, I don't have anything else. I just want, we didn't get to that one. I want to make sure we did.
Okay.
Well, okay, so I want to make sure we,
go ahead. I was just going to say, maybe just take a quick public comment and we can circle back for the last 7 or 8 minutes. Operator,
sure.
Can we open the line?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key.
And do we have any comments in the queue?
There are no comments in the queue at this time.
Okay. Raj, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay, great. Okay, so I want to make sure we get through this in the last 7 minutes. So, Carolyn, Ken, thoughts on the new format here proposed by John and Sasha?
I certainly can't claim to be an expert in this, but it makes sense to me conceptually. I can see the value of the discussion points raised, so I'm okay with it.
Same here.
Okay. All right, so, and Sasha, John, does this look okay the way that you have it now? John, is this, Sasha's doing some patchwork here, which is awesome.
Good.
Okay.
See how Sasha treated the get message transaction, but otherwise, yes. I'm sure she got the get message one well disposed of, as it were, but.
John, you didn't have our exchange request in there.
Oh, yeah. That's a current requirement, so.
Yeah, I think that would go in here, right?
Yeah, it would.
And then renewal request is new.
And I think that, you know, that probably belongs there, don't you think? The REMs were the more challenging transactions for the reasons you stated.
I could go either way, I guess.
I would say if ONC were to go along with this, that's a pretty good response. I don't know that it's necessarily bad to have that in there, unless it were thought to be insurmountable by, let's say worst case happens and 1/1/20 holds up as a retirement date of the B3 criteria, what would you want it replaced with? Would that
well, it's
be
new, and I think in my mind I'm still feeling like there's some fuzziness as to the use case for it in differentiation from some of the value of that use case in some of the other cases. So I don't know that I'd prioritize it as highly for 1/1/2020 since it is new as some of the other pieces where you clearly need it to replicate existing functionality. But I agree with you, it's less significant than REMS.
Yeah. The only thing I'd say move it down to the next category would be if you took a hard standard of if something did fall and hold to 1/1/20, you'd probably want it to be matching to the scope of the current criteria.
We'll just put in a comment that it's new and could be implemented after 1/1/2020 without loss of functionality.
There you go.
Because that's true. And then if they are looking to modulate what's necessary on a short time frame, we've made that clarity.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, Sasha, John, thank you both for driving that one. So jumping into the last one, I believe, which is Rec 28, and I think that's right.
Yeah, Denise had asked me to add a sentence about why we were doing this. I guess just to give a little context in 1 minute, the inpatient implementation guide includes a bunch of information like hospital identifiers that are not going to make sense if you are actually putting ambulatory data into a QRDA1 for a workflow of then importing it into another ambulatory system when you're transitioning systems. Similarly, if a hospital system wants to generate a QRDA3 to like look at their totals, their numbers, it's not going to make sense to have to include ambulatory identifiers like a provider tax ID in that document, and vice versa. So because the formats, the implementation guide formats, are so domain specific, is not practical to use an inpatient implementation guide in an ambulatory domain or vice versa. So I tried to add a sentence to clarify that. I can elaborate further if that'd be helpful.
I think what you added there is pretty good.
Okay, that's fine. Otherwise, I could give another sentence of clarity if that's useful. But if this is enough, then I'll keep it short.
Other folks have thoughts on this?
Yeah, the only thing I can say is maybe that if developers will not know how to comply, I think developers will be confused. Maybe it's the same thing. I take your point, Sasha. I think developers would look at this as this is absurd.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's important to say. So that's a compelling example of why that is in need of being addressed.
Okay, Sasha, thank you for making all these changes so quickly. I believe that takes us through all the other recommendations where we had comments to address. Is there...
I think, Raj, one other thing that... was on the table still with the self-developers.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, we can just resolve that in 1 minute for sure.
Okay. That was 31, right? Is that right?
I don't know that we numbered it.
31 was a security-related one, and I added a clarifying sentence at Denise's request.
Okay.
But that is not about self-development. Self-development, I think we have all of our notes, but I don't know that we've had a recommendation about self-development proposed yet. Oh, we do. It's way down at the very bottom of the document. It's not numbered.
Oh, great. Okay, right. I see it.
I would support Denise's proposal here.
Yeah, I would too. I think I've read this before. It was a good summary of our conversation.
Do we want to just vote to make this an official recommendation then?
Yeah, I think we should. Thoughts from others on the phone?
I'm okay with this.
Ken, you good with us?
I think this was the issue of, and this is for people who are seeking certification, right?
Correct.
Correct,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I'm okay with that.
Okay, good. All right, so let's add that one in. And then, Kate, what's the next step now? So I think we've been through all of this. Do we need to kind of do a vote on this right now, or how does that work?
Lauren, do you have, I think if the task force is in agreement on all of the recommendations, we will move them forward. But I think the the question was the timing for next week because of the, I think we total 37 recommendations at this point. timing and...
Yeah, I agree. So, yes, as long as we have, you know, consensus at the task force level, we don't necessarily have to have a formal vote at the task force level. If we feel comfortable with presenting these to the full committee, then and we want the committee to vote on them, then we could possibly do that for the 10th, as long as everyone feels comfortable doing that. And the other thing we discussed was, you know, is there a way to perhaps, you know, break the recommendations up so that we're not doing everything on our next virtual call later in the month. But again, you know, don't necessarily have to rush it for next week if we don't feel like we're ready.
It seems like we're ready at this point. Are there other outstanding things we need to look at?
I think we've covered everything now. I think we've been through a round of having this document available to everybody, people commenting on it, and then the last two calls reconciling those comments. So I feel pretty good about where we are. I know Denise was expressing similar sentiment, thinking that there could be some kind of just vote or whatever that would look like today. So, but I would open it up one last time for folks on the call, Carolyn, Sasha, I mean, yeah, everybody essentially. Are there any other, do you want more time to review these or are people feeling pretty good about this?
I mean, I think I'm feeling okay. There are some things that I can visualize better than others, but I'm not sure that waiting any longer would really help that given the other high-tech work that I have and my own job, of course.
Yeah. Same here.
Okay. Thanks. John, Sasha, good?
Yeah, I think so. We've covered them pretty well.
I agree. I think
okay.
There's...
Okay.
And
okay,
Ron,
good.
I can update that memo to make it final and share it with folks like one last time if that's something folks would want to see.
Sure.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I guess that's worth doing, but I think we should basically call these final and then we can talk, you know, afterwards about what we want to present next week and what we can hold off. I think we could probably extract some, and break this up a little bit given that we have so many recommendations.
Sounds good. Hey, I have to drop, but thank you. This is great.
Okay, thanks, Ken. I think we're, you know, almost 5 minutes over time, so I think we can conclude here if that works for everybody.
Yeah, that's fine.
Everyone. Have a good weekend.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yep, thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.